Thank you. All right, well, it's a great pleasure to be telling you about this work. This was really enabled by my visit here and my postdoc Frank's visit here, because we learned a lot early, I think it was in September, early September, when Simon Trast was visiting Station 2, there were Station 2 people. And he gave a talk there, and we learned a lot from him. So that was very helpful. So, you know, about 3 months ago, we were asking the following questions. If machines can learn to play Go, if you know that the game, Go, it's called Paduk in Korean, can they learn quantum mechanics? Can they learn many-body wave functions? Quantum phase transitions? And topological phases, and something else. So we were asking this question, and our answer, the reason why I'm giving this talk is because the answer is certainly, you can teach pretty much all of those that I've told you about, but with our help. That's why we're not going to be replaced by the machines. That was very important for me. So our idea is that you can teach the machines all those sophisticated concepts that, you know, we humans have invented with human physicist insight. So because I'm telling you about machine learning, and this is a relatively new topic to our community, I thought I'll give you sort of an overview of machine learning in just 5 slides, just about how much I know, and just about how much you need to understand everything we've done in our paper, and the things we are doing. So first thing about machine learning. The machine learning is all about image recognition, with the code and code and all. It's not entirely about image recognition. It's also used to recognize speech, voice, but that's also a pattern. So largely, it's about image recognition. So what do? You train the computers to recognize this as a mic with this level of success compared to these other options. Black widow, cockroach, tick, starfish, they look kind of similar, right? And this image is a container ship. This as a motor scooter. You can tell this would be pretty challenging because you can, you know, this, you're just seeing a small part of a motorcycle. And this is a leopard. So, and this is a result from AlexNet, that's a University of Toronto-based team, their neural network architecture. That's what machine learning people are doing. So we can ask the question, how about wave function? Can we recognize a wave function, a state of net? Next thing that you need to know is that these machines are trained to recognize, this so-called recognition is a process of multiple choice decision. So when given this kind of image, we're not asking the machine to come up with some understanding of deep understanding of leopard, but we're asking it to decide among some choices that's given. The choice can be quite a bit, you know, database. Often it's like about 1,000 objects, but it's still a multiple choice question. We are used to calculating, and you know, some of us really love to calculate. But if we are willing to let go of that need to calculate and know down to third decimal places, and recognize that asking a property of wave function can also be thought of as a multiple choice question, is it trivial or is it topological? And do I really care whether the you know, the entanglement entropy is really, I don't know, accurate down to third decimal place or fifth decimal place? We do that just because that's the only way we've known how to do it. We've known to calculate and try to compare that number that we get to some other number. But if you're trying to train machine, which the whole algorithm and the science behind it is being developed to make a decision as a multiple choice question, maybe we should also think about multiple choice questions. Our phase diagrams are often multiple choice questions. Is it topological or trivial? Is it cool or not cool? Is it superconductor, antiferromagnet? Usually, even in the most complex phase diagram, we don't even have 1,000 choices. We have at most 5-6 choices. So let's think about multiple choice questions. Right, you may still not know how these neural networks work. So what do these so-called neurons do is that they try to come up with this recognition as a decision by weighing and biasing input. Now, of course, I have already said it's about image recognition, so you're inclined to think about how you look at a, you know, face and recognize that person as someone, right? And whether I've gotten a haircut or not, you know, whether I'm pregnant or not, these things are perturbations, and if you've seen me in many iterations, you might be able to recognize me. But our human vision is so sophisticated, so good, it recognizes so well, at least once you're older than 6 months old, okay? And you've been all way older than 6 months for a long time, so you remember that part. So to think about this weighing and biasing that neurons do, I'm going to consider a decision-making process and training that we can more sort of think about in an engaged way. So let's imagine a kid trying to make a decision after dropping food, okay? Like my son. Inputs. What are the inputs? Number one, is mom watching? Number two, is this a vegetable? Number three, is this green? Number four, is this dessert? And then there are some more inputs that this, you know, neuron, my son's head, with a lot of neurons in it, are taking in as input. What's the output? Whether he picks it back up and eats it or not. Gulp. And how, now, you know, I don't know exactly how his brain works, but I can sort of envision how different parts of his brain are weighing and biasing this input. And that's what we call hidden layer in the lingo of the neural network. There is a reptile self, the lower part of our brain, takes these kind of inputs, and it weighs particular input more than others. For instance, younger child tend to weigh, is mom watching way too much, okay? So it will weigh different inputs with different weight. Different parts of different neuron will weigh different input with different weight, and it will bias. If mom is watching, less likely to eat. If mom is not watching, more likely to eat, for example. So that's a threshold bias. And there are other parts in the brain. You know, it's a pretty complex and large set of neurons. So there is more mature self that weighs and biases these inputs with different weight and bias, and so on. So each neuron weighs and biases different inputs with different weight and different bias. And then when these things are all added, all these numbers are added, and you can put it into this function, which is kind of like a tangent hyperbolic function. It's called sigmoid function. And if it is large, if the number is large, you're going to pick it up and eat it. If the number is small, you're not going to eat it. So that's a decision-making process. This is a model for decision-making process. Okay? So now you can see how the training would go. Training is I give him, the trainer gives feedback. No, you shouldn't be eating that food, right? So when the output is wrong, eating is a wrong output, when you get a wrong output, you tell the child that's a wrong output. And I'm not necessarily controlling all his weights and biases because I don't have control over his brain as much as I would love to. So all I can do is to keep giving feedback, okay? And the training with the neural network happens through the gradient descent with what's called cost function. So the cost function compares the output, whether he picked up and ate it or not, with my desired output, do not eat it. So my desired output, correct output, no matter what the input is, got to be zero. Untrained child's output is not zero. And it will be something that reflects his own weights and biases. Now, the cross-entropy cost function, there are many different types of cost functions, but cross-entropy as a cost function has a particularly good features. So this so-called cost function is comparing what the neuron's decision to our ideal decision. Usually we will try to train with some cases that we know the answer. And in the training process, we are making the neural network, go down a gradient descent to minimize the cost. And the cost function that's often used is called cross-entropy cost function. It's kind of an unusual looking function, but if you think about it, for our specific case, my desired output is y equal to 0, do not eat it. And if the training is successful, the neuron's decision, the network's decision is going to be A approaching 0. So when A is approaching 0, the second term is 0 because it's log 1, and this term is also 0 because y is 1. Now the overall cost approaches 0. This cost function is positive definite, and when you're successful, it approaches 0. It's got another very nice property, which is it's a differentiable function compared to, say, measure magnitude of difference between, say, y and a, which would be more conceptually simple thing to think of. But the whole point of the cost function is to use this and try to reduce it as a using a gradient descent approach and adjust these weights and biases. So adjusting weight and biases is a training process. It's sort of a multi-valued fitting process. Any questions so far? Yes?
Just to clarify, this cross-entropy cost, is that the same thing as the mutual information between the distributions?
It's not quite. Well, maybe. I don't know. I want to defer that answer to the question. Yes?
You said it's positive definite.
Yeah.
In which sense?
Because y and a will be normalized to be less than 1, between 0 and 1.
Oh, yeah, I see.
I was hoping somebody would ask this question. What if training is not successful after training for 6 years? It's what I've been doing with my son. He's 6 years old, and he still picks up and eats the food. What should I do? Okay. So first option, upgrade the network. If you think about it this way, you can see the cost, right? No way in hell I will ever do that. Emotional cost is way too high. But even with the real neural networks, it can be very costly to try to upgrade your network. And more, the problem is, as us physicists who are not professionally full-time in this, we are often using the developed network that's developed by, you know, expert computer scientists. And Google makes it cost-free, freely available, and many other schemes do. There's Azure, Google, many other options. But they are sort of black box because they are not letting us see everything. We can sort of tweak and change input, but it's kind of a black box. And it's open-ended. There is always more upgrade you can do, right? And you never know when you make that huge input investment of improving the architecture, whether you'll be successful or not. It's hard to know that. There's another option, which is the option that I opted to. That is to improve the input intelligently. See, this is the option I opted for training my son. And this is also the input I opted for training the neural network to recognize topological faces. So what do you mean by improved input? Well, you can, instead of, you know, giving those inputs that we were giving earlier, you can bring in a high-powered microscope with a connected to a big computer screen, make him see that floor with all the stuff around it. That could be one kind of input. For the problem that we want to think about, for topological phases and quantum many-body problems, we can use the input that knows about the response functions. And that's where our thoughts, our ideas, our notion of physics enter. Okay, so using machine learning for many-body physics, as of 3 months ago, because that's when I was learning about this, There were a lot of work on Ising model thermal phase transitions by Roger and his collaborators, and I'm not going to be able to cover all the references there. It's a rapidly growing field, and there are a lot of papers already. But I'll just highlight some papers that matter to us that we really read in trying to understand what we want to do. And then there was a Hubbard model at half filling, looking at dense ferromagnetism. And there was also efforts at trying to use this to solve the sign problem by Simon and collaborators, which is something that Simon talked about at the Station Q talk in September. So there are these papers and growing literature. What we took away from this was that often black boxes are used, such as Google TensorFlow. These are sophisticated, highly optimized architectures. And architectures can be quite sophisticated. Now, this is a figure from Aysen and Rogers' paper. You see that there is a lot of layers. This is actually deep learning. There's something called convolution layer. There are many, many, many parameters to make the network more and more sophisticated. And as of 3 months ago, there was no successful incidence of detecting topological order. And still, the closest it got, other than our paper, was, to the best of my knowledge, is Roger's work on Tory code. And that, again, was after a lot of effort. So 3 months ago, I talked to Roger, and he was telling me about Ising model. I asked him, what about something less, you know, less trivial? How about topological phase? And he said he's struggling. So that's where we started. We asked, because images look like a classical object, and a lot of the work that's been done so far were indeed in a classical realm. We were asking, can we teach quantum mechanics? Can we teach many-body wave function? Can we teach quantum phase transition and topological phases? And this is all of these were answered with the idea that Frank and I developed. And Frank was really the person who came up with all of this. And we named it triangular quantum loop topography. So as we were thinking about this one particular target, of topological phase, which seemed kind of non-trivial to us, we thought about what should we do, because what we've learned talking to Roger and Simon was that sort of a pixelated input of sort of an image, occupation number, and these kind of local inputs didn't work. It's clear that you should think of something non-local about topological phase. And topological phases are often defined through non-trivial loops. So we said, okay, let's think about loops. And they're insensitive to local perturbation. So perhaps we should try to think of dealing with real space so that we can handle local perturbation and impurities. They're insensitive to lattice geometry. So we thought we should think of sort of loop-like objects that are very versatile, that you can apply to any geometry. That's what got us to triangles. And then we realized that the topological phases are often defined by something being quantized. It could be Berry phase, could be Chern number. Things are quantized. So let's think sort of digital. Thinking digital here means that let's not worry about trying to give the analog input or get the analog answer out or getting three decimal places correct. But let's come up with a scheme where we make use of the fact that we actually care about the digital information. So these are all sort of vague, abstract thoughts. Waving hand in the air. But the first thing that we had to figure out was, okay, it's nice to think about triangles. We have to first figure out how we're going to image the triangles, triangular loops. So before worrying about what the triangles are going to mean, we thought about organizing the triangles by lateral dimension. So this is, on a square lattice, this is the smallest size triangle. And this is a triangle of lateral dimension 3. This is triangle of lateral dimension 1. So we organize the triangles by lateral dimension. And we are still trying to build some sort of an image. So image means there is information associated with each site. So for each of the sites, we're going to associate all the triangles that involve that site as a vertex. So for this site, length 1 triangle, there are 4 of them. And each of the triangles are going to provide me an entry to my vector, the input vector x. Then I have longer triangles, which are going to provide me with input vector further down. And I can increase the size of my input organized by the size of the triangles and study how large triangles should I include. And you can also anticipate when you have quantization and when you have, that is, quantization of the physical responses, and when you have energy gap giving you finite correlation length, you would not necessarily need to go to all different lengths of a triangle, whatever we are doing with these triangles. There will be some sense of things being local due to the finite correlation length. Yes?
But probably, so the correlation length can be arbitrarily large, especially close to the phase transition.
Yes.
Does this mean that you would need to increase the size of the triangle as you
go? If you want to be very accurate about the phase transition. And we'll see that. Yeah. So what we are now constructing is a quasi two-dimensional input image. It's not quite two-dimensional. It's more than two-dimensional because we are putting in not just one number, several numbers here of some length, vector of some length. But it's not as large as the input that Simon had to use, for example, which was all possible two-point functions forming a four-dimensional input vector. So what we are considering is a quasi-two-dimensional image input vector. That's how we're going to organize our triangles, and this is just geometry. But then we still have to figure out what are we going to let these triangles represent. And at that point, the insight we had that really Frank had from the response functions helped us. Frank realized that there are triangles in the Hall conductivity. That is, you can write the Hall conductivity using this expression where this is sum over all possible triangles, and this n is the number of sites, and pj, k, kl, lj, each of these p's are two-point functions, and this S is assigned area of the triangle. Now this is an exact identity for free fermion in a gapped topological phase, that is for Chern insulator. And Frank came to this realization because some initial attempts that he was making was coming out surprisingly successful. Without this insight, we were just trying out these two-point functions, and it was coming out surprisingly successful. And we were thinking about why is this working so well.
So
we were
lucky. What is the problem you're actually trying to solve?
We're trying. Yes, I'll get to that in a minute. Yes, but for now, I'm just trying to define what the triangles mean. Okay? I want to detect topological phase given a wave function.
Given a wave function.
Yeah. So or given a Monte Carlo configuration. Yeah.
So this actually will be quantized, this
term? Yes. Yeah. This is actually quantized.
So can I see this this expression with the relation between this relation and this expression and the Kubo formula, for example?
Exactly. I knew you were going to ask that. So, let's see. Why is it not moving? Oh, okay. So to see something like that, to believe that relationship, but it'd be better to use Blackboard because it's just a few lines of algebra. And you can actually find this statement and its proof in Kitaev's paper. Appendix F or something. One of those appendices, apparently. But Frank figured it out and he had his own derivation, which is what I'm going to present. So, that's a sort of a formula that many of us may not have seen before, but it's actually pretty straightforward to see. So here's the Kubo formula. And I'm assuming that I have, for the moment, free fermion system. The Kubo formula can be written as sum over this m and n are single particle states, and this is a states in valence band. M is states in valence band, and N are states in conduction band. And Kubo formula has a commutator expectation value of commutator of current. And I can write that using velocity. And I have energy denominator. Let's put a bracket here. So that's my Kubo formula. And now, critical thing here is to start to think about another Hamiltonian. Because I'm at the moment talking about free Fermion system, I know actually everything about the system. And I can think about another Hamiltonian, which is a flat band Hamiltonian given by just a projector. This P is a projector. Okay. And my velocities for this Hamiltonian is written as commutator because of its relation to momentum of H prime, this projector Hamiltonian and X. But this is just a projector, so I have minus I delta. Another thing to remember is that these, say here, N projector, can be related to my projector to the ground state as 1 minus P. So then we can immediately see that Hall conductivity, following the same Kubo formula, but for this Hamiltonian, is going to be given by trace of involving the position operators and the projector operator.
Denominators became the same.
Oh, here, delta.
Oh, so E is now all these ENs in the denominator just became delta.
Yes, no, there's EN squared.
And they're all the same.
There's delta squared, but there is delta here.
Yes.
And because the velocities enter twice in the
delta is a constant, so.
Pardon?
Delta is a constant, so
yes.
What I mean. So you just get rid of the denominator
yes.
And
yes.
You can sum matrix elements over.
Right, exactly. So now, I think this is squared. No, let's see. Wait. No, this delta should be gone. Because there was delta square, and I used two deltas here, so there's no delta here. Okay? Now from here, you can already start to see the coordinates starting to appear. And you can kind of see how triangles will form. And you can check that this is precisely RK minus RJ cross RL minus RJ, and this is the signed area. PJK is two-point function.
How is it related to projection operator?
Because the projection operators are written in terms of the state, but these are the position. This is sort of first quantized notation, positions. So these commutators will only operate when the for the part of the projection operator that involves this psych.
Okay.
Right? So that's how, because the part of the projection operator is written right now in the second quantized notation, but these are first quantized notation. And from when you try to evaluate these commutators, you see that what would actually come out is the amount to the two-point function of the creation and annihilation of particles at these points. You, maybe this is something that you should just sit down and think about.
So can one tell that two matrix elements of projectors come from two matrix elements in your summation, and the third projector simply defines over what you are allowed to sum?
Pardon?
And the third projector simply defines over what you are allowed to sum, because you don't sum over everything.
Oh, I'm summing over all triangles here.
But your initial sum M is in the valence band and N is outside the valence band.
No, this is in the valence band and this is in the conduction
band. Right, and that's outside. And to make sure that you only sum over all those states N, you projector.
Here, the projector was replaced by 1 minus P. Mm-hmm. And that was, there's another line above that was canceled out. So it looks like I've only used the projector, but I also used 1 minus P earlier.
Is that the bright periodic system?
I would think so. I don't see why the boundary condition would matter.
But X is not, X is not a good.
If you have, I guess here we are kind of assuming open boundary conditions. But this is not something that, so this is an insight. This is not what we actually calculate, but this is an insight that gave us idea of why the...
what happens if electrons interact? Would this formula, if electrons interact, does this formula still hold?
I don't think so, because the writing of the formula itself is explicitly assumed working with a single particle eigenstate. But we haven't tried to think hard about that question yet. Yes?
So this
Hamiltonian
H prime.
Uh-huh. I didn't answer why that is the same thing. Yeah. So sigma xy prime is for the H prime, and sigma xy I wanted to know was for some Hamiltonian H. So I simplify the Hamiltonian, but as long as I'm in a gapped phase and I have a topological, insulator, this has to be quantized, and there are only so many ways they can be quantized, so they got to be the same. I mean, these two Hamiltonians should be adiabatically connected, in other words, as long as you do not close the gap. Yes?
So when you say sum over all triangles?
Yes.
That's really triangles of arbitrary size?
Yes, right. So for that formula to actually hold, you have to sum over all triangles of arbitrary size. But, gaps, so this was what I was saying about this insight about gap system. We can actually explicitly do the calculation and check that by the time you sum to the triangles of length 3 and 4, you already get the actual correct result to the high accuracy. And in our calculation, we don't do the calculation. We don't, in our training of the neural network and in our obtaining of the phase diagram, we are not doing that full calculation. But I'll show you what we do with the triangles and the lengths.
And coming back to the previous question, I mean, it's obvious that the whole conductance has to be quantized unless the gap closes. Mm-hmm. But it's not clear that this expression of the sum over triangles holds throughout the... is that quantity actually quantized, or is it kind of... Or is it kind of digital?
The sum has to be the same, that much I know. But whether its individual terms are the same, I don't know.
The sum has to be the same
because the sum is the Hall conductivity. The sum of all the triangles. So over here, I had sum over all the triangles. I don't know. So the expression was that, this is the expression. So this is a sum over all possible triangles. And the whole thing is actually the Hall conductivity. And that would have to be the same between the Hamiltonian H and H prime.
For a plan,
yeah.
For an
Well, I guess I thought you don't have to replace the Hamiltonian by the Frank Van Hamiltonian because you have the actual energy on the denominator, but
right.
you accommodate Hx, which exactly cancels the denominator.
Right, right.
So you don't have to do this trick. It's true for arbitrary Hamiltonian.
Okay, Shinsei says it's true for arbitrary Hamiltonian, and I trust that.
So but as long as you're in the integer quantum Hall phase.
What?
As long as you're in the integer quantum Hall phase and don't close the gap, then suddenly here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think there is a more, there's a sort of a different flavor of proof in Kitaev's appendix.
So this is without.
So I'm kind of confident about the truthfulness of the statement.
Sorry, this is without interaction.
Yes, this is all without interaction. Yes, all without interaction. You know, you got to start somewhere. So that was a proof.
Is it valid with this order? Or does it assume?
I believe it will be valid with disorder, but we haven't tried that. I don't think there's a proof with the disorder.
With disorder, you technically don't have a gap, right? That's the problem. You have a mobility gap, but not the real gap. So
yeah,
so
but when you actually sum over this, you know, whole number, how off would you get with the disorder? I don't know.
So you need to define your projector very carefully. What exactly
answers?
But it was
defined in terms of two-point functions, right? The projector was part of derivation. It was, you know, ultimately the quantity is defined in terms of two-point functions. So so that was the sort of inspiration, or rather, you know, what is it called? Afterthought. We realized that the first thing we tried was working so well. But the thing actually we tried is what we call triangular quantum loop topography. And what we're doing now is instead of evaluating that full expectation value or full Green's function, we evaluate this triangle, which is associated with the product of these three complex numbers. And each complex number is obtained from a single Monte Carlo configuration. So this is a quantity that's defined without averaging. We do not have to walk through the Markov chain to get it. This is a quantity that has all the fluctuation in it. But that's what we are putting in as an input. And for each of the triangles, we are putting that as an input. And each entry, so in each of these boxes, and this vector would keep going, each entry of x is a complex value. When I say this x is now, I'm going to make the whole thing one-dimensional, line this up. So the length of the total input vector is, because it's complex values, 2 times L by L, system size, and DC is the cutoff length scale of a triangle, and D is the number of different triangles of that length.
Can I ask you, why are you using the product of this piece? Why not just to use P's as inputs?
This is what we've tried. We wanted to get a sense. I don't know whether that would work. I will have to try that. But what we did was to use these triangles. And when we use a triangle as an input, you can actually sort of see So you can look at the full expression for all the expectation values. And if you think of expectation values as sum over different Monte Carlo instances, you can see that the whole expression, the exact expression, as sum of many such things. That's why we did this.
But the neural network presumably can multiply them if this has any advantage. So why to lose information giving only products? You can give just individual piece.
So individual pieces. Are if you start to just organize individual pieces of two-point functions, which is what Simon did, your input space is much larger. And that's L to the 4 space. And this, we did the whole thing on a laptop. And Simon used the biggest, you know, supercomputer cluster in Europe. That's the difference.
Yeah.
Speed matters, efficiency matters. Yes?
So you have to do this for all triangles.
Do I do this for all triangles?
No.
Oh, okay. So here, this DC is the cutoff scale. We increase that because as we increase the cutoff scale from smallest triangle, next smallest, our input size gets bigger, and our space to do the gradient descent is bigger. Everything, you know, gets more expensive.
But if I go back to your formula, then you're mm-hmm. sum over all triangles?
Yes, it was sum over all triangles.
If I,
yeah.
If I cut off that sum, mm-hmm. so but I take a Hamiltonian and cut off that sum.
Okay.
To some DC.
Uh-huh.
You probably differ from the actual so max by by.
Right. So
how do you differ? Is it exponential? Where is the So
the difference in the phase was actually very small. To show that, I would have to get out of the screen.
So is a sigma xy minus sigma xy prime, which is cut off one, is e to the power minus.
I don't know whether we've tried to actually scale that, but this is.
So this is
calculating that Hall conductivity, cutting off the triangle at different lengths.
And this is the functional force, what's the x-axis?
Oh, this is the kappa, which I haven't introduced yet. But exact behavior for this, if you, for the moment, ignore what that is, but just trust me that exact behavior is a sort of a step function. You can see that as you increase the length of the cutoff scale, you're approaching the step function. But if I say that I really care to know that there is this phase and that phase, you can already see that why you might be able to do away with a small-ish triangle. And I will show that with the actual neural network simulation. Yes?
What's the convergence speed here? What is the convergence speed here? Is it linear or is it square?
Convergence speed in...
In the size of the triangle.
Size of the triangle. I'm not sure whether we actually evaluated that particular aspect, but I'll just show you some results we have.
The reason why I'm asking is because that defines whether you can extrapolate safely.
Yeah, there are other ways to tell whether you can extrapolate safely when you're not trying to calculate, but when you use other measures of goodness of the training, for example. So I'll get to that in a minute. Where was I? Let me just try to get back to where I was, which was, I think, here. Slide. If I've learned watching earlier, which I think I did. Yay. Okay, so now, yes, Adi.
I think you were before.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, I just want to get some physical intuition. It seems to me that this product of the P's is in some sense like a lattice discretization of the Berry curvature.
Maybe.
Is it correct to say that you're kind of passing in the Berry curvature and asking, you know?
I think we were kind of thinking about that. As I told you earlier, and there was like hand wavy slide, you know, we were thinking about Berry curvature and loops and things like that, but I'm not sure exactly.
It's a momentum space.
Yeah, Berry curvature is momentum space. This is just a, you know, evaluation of some quantity that enter.
But actually, the whole conducting it does have a form written in terms of Green's function, though. So it's actually very.
No, you're asking about the non-commutativity of the Hamiltonian with the position operator, which tells you about the local Berry curvature of the system.
You can just Fourier
transform. Very much how you do like a bot.
Fourier transform that expression, G inverse
yeah.
G.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think it's just a.
So is it a Berry curvature?
Yeah.
It's kind of more like a magnetic field, but it's.
No, it's not a real thing.
So you said that you do all that for a single Monte Carlo configuration?
Yeah.
So you just randomly choose occupations, with no regard to the Hamiltonian or anything?
I randomly choose the wave function configuration. This is a variation of Monte Carlo. So when you think of, when you try to do variation of Monte Carlo and evaluate something, right, you know your wave function exactly, but then the thing you have to do is doing that integral over the huge dimensional space, right? And when you, in the variation of Monte Carlo, the way you do that integral is by Monte Carlo steps, going through the Markov chain, evaluating that thing over and over again as you go through the Markov chain. What I am saving you is walking down the Markov chain.
So you know the wave function?
Yes.
You pick one component of it?
Yeah.
And do
you'll see that, yes. So the actual architecture, the rest of the network is as shallow as my knowledge of the neural network, and that's actually a technical term, it's called shallow network. So it's not deep. That is, we have only one so-called hidden layer, but what I wanted to avoid is the notion that this hidden layer is a black box. It is not. We've used 10 sigmoid neurons that's defined by this sort of gradually increasing function. And this network was, neural network was written on Frank's laptop, and we didn't use commercially available software. Each neuron process inputs with the independent weights and biases, like I mentioned earlier. And our weights are these matrices that are 2L squared D by 10 dimensional matrices, fully handling the complex nature of our input, and keeping the complex nature was very important. And the biases are the vectors of length L, length 10, because we've got 10 neurons. And what we do is we use 20,000 BMC samples for training, but training is happening in a particular point in the phase space where we know the answer very well. And then we're going to get the rest of the phase diagram by using the trained network, and there is this so-called validation, 4K BMC samples are used for validation. That is, as while we are training, we are observing how it's going and whether we can stop training. That purpose is to prevent overtraining. So the model that we've considered and that's showing up as a horizontal axis in the plots over and again is the first part of it is the free fermion Hamiltonian. This is just a tight binding model. And the hoppings are all staggered, so there are two sublattices. And there's imaginary hopping that's following a particular arrow direction, that's I kappa. As you increase the strength of the imaginary hopping, there is the topological quantum phase transition at kappa equals to 0.5 between a trivial insulator and a turn insulator. And you can just Fourier transform this model and notice that this is a sign changing transition for the Dirac Hamiltonian in the momentum space. So this is a trivial case. We all know the answer, but we're going to see whether we can teach the neural network something that we know the answer first. Yes?
But your input is a wave function, not the Hamiltonian, right?
Yes, our input is a wave function, but you need to get wave function from somewhere. So you get it either from Laughlin, or you get it by solving a free fermion Hamiltonian, which gives you Slater determinants. So Slater determinants are my wave function now.
So this technique would not tell you if a particular Hamiltonian has a topological ground state. You already need a candidate wave function.
That's a different question. So the technique will work whether you are starting from Hamiltonian or start from wave function. I am telling you about the case where it works for the wave function. For the Hamiltonian, you also still need some sort of image, and that can be obtained with Monte Carlo sampling. So you want to do determinant quantum Monte Carlo. So you can do DQMC and get the configurations and use them as an input. So we first tried the machine learning on fermion occupation, which I've already been advertising won't work. And so we first tried that. And the training happens with the two known points, kappa equal to 0.1, which is trivial, kappa equals to 1, which is supposed to be topological somewhere here. And this is actual data, although it doesn't look like it. But if you look very carefully, right here, there is 0 all the way here. Even without knowing what the vertical axis is, that already sounds bad. Right? Kind of obvious. What is the vertical axis? The vertical axis is the statistics on the answer. So once you have a trained network, to get, because there is some randomness to it, to get statistics so that we know how well it is doing, we did samples, testing on 2,000 samples, and statistically, perfectly, this was behaving badly. The network could not be trained with that input. That was a bad kind of input to be used. And then instead, we used a triangular quantum loop topography as an input. So this is a fermion occupation, knows nothing. Nothing at all about going from mundane insulator to turn insulator. But we use TPL topography, and these are different cutoff lengths. So the plus sign is using the smallest triangle only, and with increasing cutoff. And you see that away from near the phase boundary, near the critical point, they are just really lining up. And it's just at the vicinity of the critical point, there's a little bit of difference in going from one length scale cutoff to another, which sort of indicates that if all you care is getting sort of a big picture of the phase diagram, you can probably get by with the smallest length scale.
So this is open boundary conditions?
What's this open boundary condition? No, probably periodic boundary condition, I would think.
So
the wave functions we are using is just the Slater determinative e to the IKL with k taken from the dispersion. Yeah. So open or closed will make a difference on where the k points are.
Yes? So in the previous slide, what was the input instead of these triangles? What were you giving as input?
Just the occupation number. That's the first most obvious input that people use. Yes, for example, right. So in a spin Hamiltonian, the most obvious input will be the spin expectation, spin value itself, which fails in trying to when you try to use that to detect topological order. And for a fermion Hamiltonian, most obvious input, because you're trying to get some sort of scalar image, is the occupation number, which fails here. Okay.
Could you repeat what P is, the vertical axis?
The vertical axis is statistically, we've got this neural network that's been trained, right? And we give a configuration and see whether it decides it's topological or not. Give another configuration, see whether it decides topological or not. And do that statistically and see what it answers over some 2,000 samples so that we can get statistics.
But statistics was what? So if you have an answer of 0.1.
Chance of success.
Yeah, answering topological. So if this was perfectly trained, it should answer topological for all values of kappa greater than 0.5. And all values of less than kappa point, great, less than 0.5, it should answer with 100% chance that it's trivial. So this gives me a sense of accuracy.
But somewhere inherent in the code, there should be the quantity that you're probing, that probably what you proved over there on a board that was on the previous slide. Are you actually taking the sum?
Sorry, could you repeat?
Yes, so when you show the proof starting from the Kubo formula,
yes.
The formula you have on the board.
Yeah.
Including the product of three PIJs.
Yes.
Are you using that formula to probe whether or not the state is topological? Are you looking at the quantization of sigma x1?
No, we're not looking at the quantization. We've trained the network to think these sorts of wave functions are trivial and these sorts of wave functions are non-trivial.
Referring to any quantity, you just said
yes.
Above 0.5
yeah.
Topological.
Because the neural network just gets those x that I've designated as input, those triangles, giving this lone vector, and with my feedback, it's learned, it's adjusted its weights and biases based on my feedback.
But your feedback sucks.
That's the training process. Okay? Yes?
I have a physics question, which is if I actually just took these two-point functions and fed it in, this is actually a nonlinear object that gives me the Hall conductivity.
Yeah.
Do I actually expect to get for a single Monte Carlo snapshot the actual quantized
No. Single Monte Carlo snapshot will not give you the correct answer. It would have all the fluctuations in it. That's why instead of evaluating, when you try to evaluate situations with analog sort of mindset, you can be sort of I kind of think this talk is somewhat interesting, but right? And that number can be somewhere in between. But if you're asked to decide between 0 and 1, are you going to stay or leave? Because you cannot be halfway between. It's a sort of a simpler thing. That by that digitalizing output process, we are in a way seeing through the fluctuation without having to average. That's our view on how it's working. Oh. This is something that I...
There is an averaging process, right? That P is average.
That P is average, but compared to the typical Monte Carlo averaging that you would have to do, this
you're
is
not
nothing.
Doing any thermal
yes,
averaging.
Because after doing the averaging, we found out in the phase, I get 99.9 accuracy. What that means is if I randomly generate give a random one configuration, actually I need three. If I give three configuration, and make it decide, there's 99.9% chance it will get it right.
If you are at the extent.
If you are away from the critical region, right. In the critical region, to get that accuracy, you have to include larger and larger loops. Makes sense, right?
So actually, on that precise point, so it seems like increasing from 1 to 3, the cutoff.
Yeah, it doesn't really improve.
Yeah. That also has to do with the training length, how long we train, what is our... So in the training process, what we do is we take two point data points, 0.1 and cap equal to 1. And we train until the network performs reasonably well. We're never going to reach the cost function of actual zero. We have to stop training at some point.
So could it be that since you're training in such far extremes, basically...
That's possible. To get it right, we might want to train closer. But our main objective was to detect the existence of topological quantum phase transition and to be able to get a big picture of the phase diagram. And now I want to move on to the non-trivial part. So yes, free Fermion Hamiltonian, I can, you know, free transform it on a piece of paper. After all, I'm smarter than machine. And you look at the mass sign change. But this is something that I really need to work much harder, which is nu equals 1/3 fractional Chern insulator. So what we've done here was one way to get a fractional Chern insulator. Again, I'm not going to do justice on making all the reference to large literature on fractional Chern insulator. But one way to get fractional Chern insulator in the VMC perspective is to cube the parent free Hamiltonian, the parton wave function we obtained in the previous slide. So when you cube that, you get a variational Monte Carlo sense, a wave function. You get a wave function that kind of looks like Laughlin wave function. And we first tried using the network that was trained with the free fermion, that's the inset. And what you see is that for small kappa, it still decides that it is trivial. But for kappa slightly greater than 0.5, it sort of starts to think that this is something else.
But you don't have that Kitaev formula anymore.
Right, I don't have that formula anymore. Right, I don't have the formula.
So
yes.
What do you use to decide whether...
So my training procedure is the fact that I know that kappa large, that this must be Chern insulator, fractional Chern insulator. So I need to have some knowledge about some extremes of the phase diagram for training.
But then, before you said you could try training on an occupation number and you failed.
Right.
You could try training on time.
Triangular quantum loop and it succeeded, right.
What did you try training here on?
Triangular quantum loop. The same triangular quantum loop we used for...
Formula.
Yes, same formula. We use the same algorithm, the triangular quantum loop algorithm. And it's working really well. If you train, first of all, it works even with the neural network that I just took from having trained on the free fermion Hamiltonian. It's not saying this is topological in the sense that it's been taught to be topological. The probability is much smaller, but it is beyond error bar. It's kind of detecting that this is a different kind of something else, right? And this is a very, very primitive neural network that we are using here. Now for if we train with the cubed wave function this time. Now I take the one kappa equal to 0.1 determinant qubit, kappa equal to 1 determinant qubit, use that as a training set. And what we see is that, and we train with one ground state sector. Now there are three degenerate ground sectors. I train with one degenerate one ground state sector for system size L equals 12 by 12. Now you see that there is one line here for one ground state, and then I try a different ground state, that is the circles. That's ground state sector number 2, ground state sector number 3, and there is some difference between the ground state sector that I've been using to training, for training. But that difference between the three ground state sectors becomes much smaller if I go to larger system size. Now these field symbols are all 16 by 16 system, and you can see that they're much closer together. And now the topological quantum phase transition that was detected for the first time here occurs at kappa greater than 0.5. And you can sort of understand that at 0.5, there is no, around 0.5, the gap of the parent parton Hamiltonian is very small. And for all kappa less than 0.5, it is trivial and it stays trivial. But for it to sort of really overcome the gauge fluctuation, seems to need to go beyond kappa equals to 0.5 to some further into the kappa value. Now, this phase diagram has never been obtained before, because to obtain this any method before would have to be to take this variational Monte Carlo wave function, calculate topological entanglement entropy. And each one of those calculations, this took us, for a given point, we took 2,000 samples. Each one of entanglement entropy calculation takes millions, millions of Monte Carlo steps. And we...
So yes. Do you know what your neural network is actually doing after all this training? Do you know what
it has arrived at some values of weights and biases.
But does it actually calculate the conductivity using whatever?
No. It just has been come to weights and biases.
So there's no way to see what kind of
you can look at the weights and biases, the numbers, whether it revealed anything.
I mean, it sounds more like pattern recognition in some sense. I mean, when I look at your face, you know, Victor, I'm saying, oh, that looks like Victor. You know, what exactly goes in my brain is very hard to say.
Well, but here probably there is some way to extract information.
But there may be some way to extract information, and that was one of the things that we wanted to understand how these things work better. And that's why we wanted to write everything ourselves, so that we can poke it and look at it, but we haven't yet gotten to that. Now, there are a lot of questions, but I need to get to my punchline, so I'll get the questions afterwards, okay? So, the thing that I want to show off is that this whole phase diagram took 10 minutes on a laptop, and whether we do this with the interacting model or, you know, free fermion model doesn't matter, with 99% accuracy away from the critical point. And it recognizes near degeneracy. It you can see the finite state scaling, and this is the first detection. So what are the advantages of this approach? So if we compare TQL topography machine learning with the conventional topological entanglement entropy, the cost on our side here was that we do 20K VMC samples for training on the two extreme points of the phase diagram. And we used 2,000 VMC samples for testing, just because we didn't know how well it would do statistically. But after testing with 2,000 samples for each phase-based point, we found out that it does well with 99.9% accuracy away from the critical point. So if we are to do this with some new model, with this our understanding of the algorithm, now we would not necessarily, you know, do 2,000 samples. We might be able to do with 3 samples. And the whole phase diagram was obtained rather rapidly. Now contrast this in terms of the cost and the effectiveness of the conventional topological entanglement entropy. Topological entanglement entropy is an interesting, sophisticated, beautiful concept, but it's, you know, by now kind of conventional in the sense that we all know that's what we're supposed to do. So now what you have to do is you're supposed to divide the space into three regions, A, B, and C, and calculate entanglement entropy for each of the regions, A, AB, ABC, BCC, AC. And each of those entanglement entropy calculations take 1 million steps. And then you're trying to look at that small, tiny, tiny, tiny difference between these numbers. It's a very painful calculation. And if you want to motivate somebody to get a full phase diagram using this, you know, good luck. Because it's just going to take so much time. You know, Frank and I have both done entanglement entropy calculations with variational Monte Carlo. We really appreciate the efficiency of this approach. Versatility, because it's a completely real space-based approach, we believe this is going to be robust against disorder. We haven't tried this yet. It's applicable to any lattice geometry. We've already tried it on a honeycomb lattice. It works fine. Higher dimensions are accessible. Compared to the kind of size of the data that the neural networks out there are trained to handle, our input size is so small, going to 3D is not a big deal. And we detect the topological degeneracy as well, so this versatility is another advantage.
Detect the topological degeneracy?
In the sense that when we gave a degenerate wave function topologically in a distinct topological sector, it recognizes as representing the same phase.
It recognizes as representing...
Yes, so the thing is, we took one sector, used that for training, okay? And then in somewhere in the middle of the phase diagram, we gave a wave function in a different sector, which we can obtain by flux threading. And we asked, do you think this is topological or not? It says it is topological. It answers correctly.
Should this be surprising? Because the input is local, and locally they are not distinguishable.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. But the reason why variational Monte Carlo sort of DQMC, one of the reasons why people do not use DQMC, even when you do not have sign problem, is because in Monte Carlo, to have some sense of degeneracy is not trivial.
Let me put it differently. You could train your network on to try and distinguish different topological wave functions, but I think there it would different wave functions from the same phase but different degenerate states.
It distinguished.
Really? Where? Yes. No. Same phase.
Yes, same phase, different wave function. Yes.
But that plot doesn't show it.
So. You can mainly in the sense that you can see that they are distinct by how they are going through the phase transition. Because I get the question. Okay, now the question is you are asking for a different kind of multiple choice. I have given only two choices, right? So now if I want to ask, is this sector 1, sector 2, sector 3, and trivial, I need to give it four choices.
But also
you haven't done that yet.
But
that should be possible.
But it would be very surprising, I think, if you can, by a local measurement, decide whether you are... In which sector you are.
That's right.
Imagine you have all the information in the world.
I guess that's what we should do next.
Yeah, right. But
nice challenge. Thank you.
This would be very, very surprising.
Okay.
It would be against what we believe.
I see. Yeah. All right.
But presumably you can choose larger DC, the triangle.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't want to put limits on, you know, where my child would go. So challenge is great. All right. So the first advantage is the efficiency, and then versatility. Finally, the third advantage is that the sort of what we've learned in these 3 months from posing the question, learning what we needed to learn, and, you know, having some success. We learned quite a bit from our own perspective. What we learned is that, you know, if you want to go after some other target, some other phase, we can always be guided by physical insight. And when we are guided by our physical insight in designing the input structure, it's kind of like deciding what kind of camera you're going to use, whether you're going to use a pinhole camera, whether you're going to use an iPhone, you know, it's kind of like deciding on which camera to use depending on your target. When we are guided by physical insight, we know when it is going to work. Many of the experiences that our colleagues had so far was that it was really trial and error, a lot of exploration. And when we are guided by some physical insight about our idea about phase and the choices that we wanted to distinguish, we can sometimes keep, at least from our experience, keep the neural network rather simple. And this principle, this perspective, which is what I really want to communicate, that you can think about the input, put in your intelligence, our thoughts into input, and that can really pay off, can be extended to other problems, and make sure that we are irreplaceable. I think that's also an important advantage, right? So that's all I had to say, and thank you for your attention. And I'm now going to take more questions. Yes?
You have a bullet point about keeping the neural network simple.
Uh-huh.
Now, your network is indeed relatively simple, but there's still room for improvement there. Did you try using zero hidden neurons? So this is just a logistic regression.
Okay, so if you ask me, have I tried? I can answer probabilistically, I haven't.
No, but
been in this social.
It's a serious question nonetheless.
If you are suggesting us, you know, something that we haven't thought about and we don't know, we would love to learn about that.
But why 10? I mean,
why 10? I don't know. We tried 10 and it worked. Okay.
Yes. Did you try zero? So
we haven't tried zero. I would love to talk more about zero, but that goes beyond what I can answer. So we can talk more later, and I will take other questions for now. And other questions? Yes?
In this triangular input that you've used, mm-hmm. can you specify again what quantities you've provided, the occupation numbers on all possible...
No, not occupation numbers. So what you do is you take a Monte Carlo, you know, instance snapshot of the wave function, and evaluate with that snapshot CI dagger CJ.
That's right. But do you do it for all pairs of sides? Yeah. To encounter for all possible sizes of triangles? Or
No. I organize this by the size of the triangles, and I first try with the smallest triangles only.
That's right.
And see how it does. And I try with the first smallest triangle and the next bigger triangle, and saw how it worked. And we concluded that away from the phase boundary, it seems to be sufficient to just wait the smallest triangle. For the plots, I think we've used smallest and the next larger, which we call the cutoff length scale, DC. So our DC for all sort of meaningful things was 2.
So now that I understand procedure better, my question is really about the first point. We uh-huh. know when it is going to work.
Yes.
Well, if somebody gave you a model that uh-huh. you're not sure, or they take Heisenberg
model. Okay, now.
Well, then maybe okay.
Yes, okay. Now, if you give me something that I have totally no idea about, that's a different sort of branch of machine learning. So what I'm doing here is what's called supervised machine learning, where you have some idea about some parts and use the ideas that you have to train. If you give me something that you have no idea about, what kind of phases that it will ever, you know, realize, that you cannot approach with this supervised machine learning, because you have to give it the choices, multiple choices.
But
you need to have some insight.
Right, but here's a suggestion. So imagine you took your neural network that has been trained on this problem.
Yes.
And now you fed it uh-huh. a wave function uh-huh. on exact non-interacting Hamiltonian,
yes.
which is some modification of the one you wrote on the board. Still yes. has complex hoppings, but let's say it's a pi flux. Or uh-huh. you know, some other phase, right?
Uh-huh.
Something that a different fractional quantum hop.
Uh-huh.
And then you feed that to the same neural network without changing any training protocol.
So what we
ask, well, is that topological?
We haven't tried that. What we did try was changing the lattice geometry. When we used the network that was trained on, because the architecture itself is independent of the geometry. When we tried the neural network that was trained on a square lattice and gave it the honeycomb lattice, it wasn't getting it right. But if we trained with both honeycomb lattice and square lattice, then it gets both right. So it's looking for some pattern, you know, it's taken the whole image. Even the face recognition that your iPhone would do, if you take a picture, you know, and it get organized by people, right? It's taking that image data and putting it, making it a vector, and feeding it. And in that vector, some things will have some recurring pattern, right? But analysis of that is much more complicated, you know, way beyond what I can describe. But whether, if you keep the same geometry and give a wave function that's in the same universality class, would it detect it? That's an excellent question. We haven't tried that yet. Yes? Oh, Harun, yes.
They're Hamiltonians where the phase diagram looks like the problem. You have, say, a non-trivial topological phase. Plus three fermions just to start from.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say chair number one, then you tune the parameter equal to zero,
mm-hmm.
then increase the parameter further, you go back to one.
Okay.
It's a re-entering transition.
Okay.
So one can similarly consider interacting version of squaring
okay.
them or doing fractional.
Mm-hmm.
Have you studied those things? Because there, then the question arises, where do you train? Because the re-entrant transition, do you really detect either three cases or two cases?
Yeah. That's an excellent question. Probably we can try that with the architecture we already have, mm-hmm. if you give me the wave function or the, you know, free fermion model. We would love to try that.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you're testing for topological order, you're summing a bunch of these triangles of different sizes.
Yeah.
Is that always dominated by smaller size triangles, or is there something like
to, it seems
like ramps up and then drops off?
It seems to be dominated by smallest triangles when the correlation length is short.
Mm-hmm.
When the correlation length gets longer, then you know more and more triangles need to be taken into account.
But just to point out, I don't think at any point the computer actually calculates that stuff. It just takes this input, the value of PIJ of different triangles, that's it. but it's not actually put it in that formula and calculating.
No, it is not calculating. It's not calculating.
But it could well be that the internal state of the network does actually compute the sum weighted by the weights that are equal to the triangle areas.
Maybe.
It could even be that it's the best one can do.
Maybe, yeah.
Did you try to actually do that?
No.
I see.
Yes, this is a very, very simple question. So suppose you trained on like turn number one, right? So say in the positive direction, but then you actually try to determine whether the system was reverse B, right? So was the arbitrary number would be recognized?
Yes. I think so. It does work.
Yeah.
It recognizes. So I have to be careful. So we've only used two outputs, 0 and 1. So output had to be of the right sign. And I think we had to give the right time reversal symmetry broken pattern. The wrong pattern, opposite sign, I think didn't work. But I don't quote me on that. I will have to ask Frank. He vaguely mentioned something about it, but I don't remember in detail.
Okay, I see at least three more questions. So we move.
Yeah, I had a question. I think this is very exciting to get the phase diagram. But I was wondering, is there some? It seems to me that it might be biased depending on how you decide to train it and what you give it. And I'm just wondering, is there some systematic way in which you could give it more information and train it, so that you could prove in some limit that it becomes unbiased? I mean, even though you may not want to actually do it in that crazy limit, at least it'd be nice to know if there's some way in which it could be
so
systematic.
So I guess for the so the limit here would be to keep all the triangles and to put, instead of to put the single instance number, you can put the instances from lots and lots of Monte Carlo steps.
My understanding is even if you did that, you can't prove that it's unbiased, right?
I'm not sure if I can ever prove that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Not sure, yeah. But we were happy to have, we are happy that we have at least this length scale of the triangle as one way of sort of systematically increasing the input size, as opposed to you either give just the occupation number or give a four-dimensional, you know, big data. So, you know, this idea of organizing in terms of the loops or some appropriate geometry of the correlation function, given the target state that you want to understand, gives us some way to think about how we're going to organize this structuring of the input, rather than, you know, all or nothing, try this, wait, you know.
Is there a notion of symmetry of these weights and biases after training? For example, there's no reason probably to weight, you know, triangles of the same size differently, right? On a lattice, you have a bunch of symmetry.
Yes.
Can you check if it trains itself to be symmetric in some sense?
Perhaps we haven't. So we haven't really dug into our weights and biases much. It would be interesting to study that, and really to be able to go into these kind of questions was the reason why we wrote our own network where we can look at all this. So, yeah.
But you don't impose any additional.
No. All we impose is the feedback. Feedback given by the cost function, right?
I'd like to be a bit more careful with respect to the fractional part,
mm-hmm.
because particularly with this term of phase transition and so on. So what you do is you have the non-interacting wave functions, the theta determinants for values of kappa,
mm-hmm.
then you cube them.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask the system, can it distinguish by looking at the cube of the wave function, mm-hmm. can it distinguish whether the original one was from u equals 0 or from u equals 1?
Mm-hmm.
Just a second. You're only on the level of the wave function, right? There's no Hamiltonian for the u equals 1 third.
Right.
So you look at wave functions and you ask, can you distinguish by looking at the wave? You ask your system.
Yeah.
By looking at the wave functions, right. Can you tell whether it looks more like one class than the other?
Right.
But it's not really a fair transition between states. You know, there's no Hamiltonian where the gap closes and a new one opens and so on. And it's not the whole conductivity. Mm-hmm. We're looking at wave functions and we're asking whether, you know,
we're classifying wave functions.
You're classifying wave functions,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we're classifying wave functions. That's exactly what you do with EMC.
It's a classification of wave functions.
Yeah.
It's not classification of all conductivities.
I never claimed that it's
degeneracy
all. Okay. But if one were to do this with a Hamiltonian, then it could be.
Then it could be wonderful.
Which we will.
It's a different story.
On.
Yeah.
A related question. So for this wave function Q, have you tried to check actually? Use some other method to determine the phase boundary?
I've told this, I've discussed with several people about this, and several people told me that they were working on calculating entanglement entropy to topological entanglement entropy to detect the critical point at some point, but because without any idea, that's a very expensive undertaking.
Why not just look at the Green's function? Yeah, exactly.
Green's function.
It has become gapless. It has become power log correlation at some point.
Yeah. That would require calculation too. That would be a BMC calculation as well, detecting a gap vanishing, right? And I, to the best of our knowledge, nobody has done it yet.
That would be interesting because
it's
not obvious that the machine actually.
Yes, absolutely.
Knows, you know, it might be just looking for.
Right. So what we know about what this network have been able to learn is it have been able to learn that this wave function cubed wave function for large kappa is different from wave function cubed for small kappa. Also, it is different from uncubed. It knows that at a given kappa, it is different from uncubed. Okay, that's how far we've been able to educate it.
Okay, I think we have asked many, many questions, so let's go.